Welcome, everybody. Ha Lachma Anya. This, right here, we point at the Seder, is the poor bread, it's the bread of affliction. It may be the bread of answers. We'll find out about that for a little bit. But this is a very complicated section of basically three clauses. It almost makes no sense at all. We're used to it because as little kids, it's the first thing in the Haggadah. So when you're in school, you make a little Haggadah. I'm sure my kids will come home with a Halachmani. Listen to the expressions. This is the bread of affliction that our forefathers ate in the land of Egypt. Halachmani di achlu ahavasana ba'arad mitzrayim. This is the bread of affliction that they ate in Egypt. Good. Anyone who's hungry, come and join us and have Pesach with us. That has nothing to do with what kind of bread this happens to be before, right? It's not connected at all, it would seem. This happens to be a certain kind of bread, which, even though they ate it when they left Egypt, they also ate it when they were still slaves. Interesting tidbit. Most people don't know that. By the way, if you're hungry, come join us. Yeah, so the hospitality is see Ed or Ethel Fromowitz, who can find you a Shabbat meal. Yeah, and now we are here next year. Hopefully we'll be in the land of Egypt. Forgive me, that's not where we want to be. I saw recently an ad for spend Passover in Egypt. In other words, there was a real nice Pesach hotel, and you could go back to Mitzrayim. And then they went on to describe, isn't that funny? All the Pesach hotels, so what do they have? They focus, if you look at what they're focusing on, what are the ads? We have this unbelievable food. We have private tennis lessons with a coach, right? So in other words, you may be doing it in San Diego or in
Egypt,
anywhere else, but you're doing it, I mean, the ad is come on back to Egypt for just one holiday. We'll have minions, but just one more Egypt holiday. Okay, the truth is, listen, we'll discover that when they left Egypt, they took their money.
You'll pay.
Isn't that something? They took their money and they took their clothes and they put it on their kids. One of the reasons that the Jews got out of Egypt is because they didn't wear the clothing of the Egyptians. We all heard this. They didn't change their names, their language, their clothing. Then they leave Mitzrayim, and the Pasuk says in the Torah that they took the clothing that they got from the Egyptians and put them on their children. So the Chasam Sofer told a joke. He says, you know, Hasidim wear the long jackets, but modern people wear the short suits. It's modern. It's goyish. So they said the Egyptians were modern. They dressed like modernish people. So what they do, they had short jackets. So what they put on their kids. That you could wear to the Hasidic Shecher, you know, that's the Chasam Sofer's joke. But that's why they put on their kids and on themselves, right? No, but the truth is that you see that once we leave Egypt, and we have a Torah, then we can wear their clothes, and we can use their money. Because we can use all that to go back to take a close session. But nevertheless, next year we don't want to be in Egypt. We'd rather be in Arad Yisrael as free men. We want to be in the land of Israel. So three things in Halakha Ani. This is the bread of affliction. If you're hungry, join us. Right now we're slaves, but next year we hope to be free. We hope to be out of exile in the land of Israel. Those are three beautiful and interesting things, and they seem disjointed. So tonight we're going to focus on each one and learn how this is one tremendously powerful piece of Torah energy that once you understand it and internalize it will change your seders and your life forever. Unless you space out 80% of the class, then I'm like, whatever. You know. So, yeah, you see the windows become one window. You want to ask them?
Yes, one question. So I know, so when I was in Jerusalem two summers ago, see, the people would bring white striped pajamas almost, but it's like striped.
Yeah.
Is that used to be different from other Jews? Or?
That's a good question. You kind of have to go back to that. We love to go back to that. That's a good
question. So I don't even know Yom, because you know how the Pope has a Yom Kippur?
Yeah. It's a very interesting thing. You know, the truth is that it's just a completely different culture. It's a completely different culture. So how they started wearing it is a fantastic question. But you're absolutely right. The reason that they wear it today is to identify with their group of people because they're proud. They want to walk down the street and someone say, you're a told us Aaron Fasser. They're not humiliated by it. They're very proud of it. Even in our communities, very much the way we dress is a tremendous sign of who you want to identify with. In other words, there's very few people who believe that a guy's walking down the street wearing a black hat. So it's not that he believes that the gematria of the word black in Hebrew is something. It's complete nonsense. I mean, if he was living in Europe 50 years ago and living in Slobodka, 10 years before the World War, he would have a white hat on because they wore colorful clothes. So why is he wearing this one now? That's just because he's very proud to identify with his community.
Is that all it represents? Like,
which represents a lot.
Right, but I'm saying, is that meaning it's saying, like, because I associate with a certain, like, hashgacha or mentality? Oh.
I'll tell you why it's actually really, really important, believe it or not. I always thought it was really stupid. I really thought, like, okay, practically, it made sense to me. You know, I was learning in Waterbury, so there was, you know, I was in yeshiva in Waterbury for the first 6 years of the yeshiva, more or less. So everybody wore colored shirts, like you didn't only wear white dress shirts for Shabbos, you wore white in the week, whatever. When I decided to go spend some time learning in the mirror, everybody there wears white. So I had one friend who said, it's so stupid that I'm not going to go there. So what he did is he threw out the baby with the bathwater. He had an opportunity to learn in a place that he believed was best for him, where he'd be surrounded by people. I mean, I sat in the mirror base medrash, in the main base medrash, to learn on a Shabbos afternoon, and the guy sitting next to me knew all the shas on both sides. Both, like, that's what the experience was to me. So, I don't know, I don't care that much about what I'm wearing. It's worthwhile for me to sacrifice a little bit of that self-expression. Instead, the fellow who made his life decision, because I think clothing is stupid, holds that clothing are much more important than anything else. So you have to realize the following is very, very important, that when you accept I've spoken about this before, but it's everything in life, the way that, if you want to look at it from a Torah perspective, after the Chet Adam Rishon, every single community, every single person, every single thing has its positives and negatives, Tov and Ra is mixed everywhere. So it means if you marry somebody, they have positives and negatives. There are the things you love about them, and then there are the things that you could do with them. But there is nobody without them. If you want to have a child, who doesn't want to have a child? So you're going to have diapers. And you don't get children without diapers. You don't get children without runny noses and without them crying in the middle of your gift this year. And it's fantastic. I mean, what are you going to do? That's not a choice otherwise. In fact, when a person embraces that and says, listen, one day my house will be empty and quiet, and I will wish for the times when I was interrupted from a good night's sleep from that same kid, you know? So it can become even very meaningful that that we value these things. Hi, Demi. Welcome.
Sorry, Mike.
No problem. So, the principle is this. If you want to accept anything in your life, people spend a lot of time complaining about the part of their job that they don't like. So what are you going in for? Because it's better for me to keep the job with the part I don't like than give it up. Because if it was better for me to give it up, I'd give it up. No, I have no choice. You have the choice. And you're choosing to keep it. Person stays married, but they don't like something about their spouse. I mean, you're choosing the positives over the negatives. You'd rather be married and have an intact family than you would not have that at this time, right? So in other words, we really make these choices, but a lot of times we focus on the negative. By a comfortably saying, I am in this, it means I identify with this. I'm part of this group. If you don't pick a school for your kids, you're going to have one school that's a little bit too far to the right and one that's a little too far to the left. So these people are fanatics, and these people are atheists, because that's how it goes. The guy who's this much more religious than you is nuts, and the guy who's this much less is like, you know, deserves to be killed for his atheism. So it's really challenging now. Like, what are you going to do? What school are you going to pick? So that's always a challenge. But what you have to realize is, whichever one you do, you're taking positives and negatives with both. There's no one place that's like the panacea. It's just, that's the answer to everything. No, but you understand. And of course, the guy who's trying to get you to pay him tuition will explain to you why his school is the one place on earth where... So this is very, very important to grasp. I've actually noticed that people that are not comfortable identifying with a certain group because of one thing or another, so they won't make even the smartest decision. A woman recently told me, or actually the husband who told me, that they pulled their children out of a certain school, which they were very happy with, because the wife dressed a way that wasn't really up to the standards of a lot of the people in that school. So she felt really uncomfortable when she would show up for like parent-teacher conferences, once every year, one time a year. In the carpool line, you can't tell who's, you know. And so for that reason, they pulled their kids out of that school. So I always thought, like, the way you dress really doesn't matter. But now I start to see. The fellow who dresses a certain way can be really uncomfortable when he walks into a shul where they daven seriously. Because, and rightfully so, he says, what really is the difference? What color my pants are? I dress nicely and I'm going to shul. But if you discover that by not buying in to the little bit of silliness and a little bit of negatives, you also lose all the positives. So you have to take the normal approach that we take to everything in life, which is looking at the big picture. In the long-term perspective, what's the very best choice? So it's a little bit of an aside, But it's a very, very important and commonly asked question about the clothing thing, and it's very powerful. It's generally unhealthy when people feel terribly bullied and badgered into doing anything. So that's always a challenge. If you're in a community where like it's terribly humiliating to not dress just exactly like everyone else, that's a very, very hard way to live. It's a lot of pressure. We don't want to create that in our families and in our schools and our kids. We really want to take, but for our own selves, to realize that sometimes dressing the part and fitting in is extremely beneficial in 100 different ways. And it means just kind of, I was trying to think of who I was losing with it. Maybe somebody in this room who I was telling recently that if I had my way, I would, I guess this is recorded, so I can't deny it as easily. But like if it was completely up to me and I lived on a desert island and I had my own personal tailor, like I would dress very differently. But I would not have the opportunities to speak in the world that I live in if I didn't have the same dark conservative suits and the black hat and the white shirt. And like, really, I would have a completely different, so just being practical and dealing with the realities, like if I were to dress like my great-grandfather in Slobodka, you know, and look like a real, you know, cream-colored fedoras and like a real mafioso, that'd be great, but I wouldn't have any stance. So this is a very, very, okay, but it's relatively simple and straightforward. I mean, it's not, this is no mind-blowing observation, and yeah. Sometimes even simple things are helpful to consider. In any event, what is the deal with halach ma'ani leading into kol dichtin yesei v'yechol? Why is it that when we identify the matzah as bread that our suffering ancestors ate, that the next thing is kol dichtin yesei v'yechol? Moshe Rabbeinu, does anybody know what his mother named him? I mean, they must have given him, when they gave him a bris, they must have given him a name. They didn't wait until 3 months later when Basya Bas Paro is going down to convert and says, well, Moses. So what was his real name? So I'm not going to tell you. Because that's not the point. Okay, I'll tell you some theories. It may be Avigdor, it may be Yekusio, maybe Tuvia. There's a number of names that are given in the Medrash, 10 names. This one's given by Hashem, and this one's given by the parents, and this one's given by Stan. But the truth is that no one knows that. Nobody knows that. And that's not the name the Torah uses. Hashem chose the name, so why? So the Sforno says the reason is because Moshe was pulled from the water. And so it became his job to save others. The name Moshe does not mean really pulled from the water. If you look at it grammatically, that would be Mashui. Mashui would be pulled from the water. Moshe is a person who goes and saves other people. The daughter of Paro understood as she took Moshe out that this is, you're going to be a child who saves people. Because he was saved. Since this morning, when something was done for you, you can spend the rest of your life as a victim. We were slaves. And that's not fair. And we expect a lot of free stuff. That is one orientation that some people have. They have a certain victimhood, they had a really tough childhood, and now they expect the world to treat them more kindly. Another solution is to become the same. So the best drug counselors are people who themselves battle drug addiction. The people who have the hardest times with certain things. So Moshe, that's the response. Halach ma'ani, our ancestors had a really tough time. So what do Jews do when they talk about that? You know, the next word out of our mouth is, you know, children sitting with me at the Seder, they were really, really, really bad to Jews. Do you know anybody? Can you think of anybody who needs help, who's hungry? This is not the time to invite guests, obviously. Yeah, I got an email this week from a woman in Yerushalayim saying, if anybody knows of guests for the Seder that need a place in the Old City, we're actively looking now. Because if you try to look after, yeah, oh, we're supposed to invite lots of guests. Great, everyone lock the doors. Kadesh, Urchatz, Karpaz, Yachatz. All right, seriously, nobody? No guests? Oh, okay, I guess we'll keep going. Right, it's ridiculous. The answer is no. Of course you've got to invite guests earlier. But the answer is, you cannot even say, we used to suffer. Without turning around and saying, okay, we used to suffer, then we better pay that forward. We better... Hashem saved us, we used to suffer, we know what it's like. Torah says, not to make trouble with converts, strangers. Don't be mean to a ger. Why? Because you know what it's like to be a stranger. You were strangers in Mitzrayim. That's what Torah says. You know what it's like. Jews identify with the underdog. This is always the case. The truth is, it's one of the things that it appears to me that in a certain way Christian culture has adapted as well. So I noticed this very interesting thing. If you poll Americans, imagine you're sitting down, and somebody flips on the television, and it's March Madness, right? March Madness. So basketball teams that you've never heard of before from two colleges playing a game, and one of them is down by 3 points with 2 minutes left. Or really in anything. Who do you root for? Who do you root for? I mean, the one who's losing. The underdog. That is a very Western thing. It's something that comes from Jewish values. We'll show you in a minute a pasuk about this. The idea that the Jew identifies with the underdog. In Middle Eastern culture, they do not. They can't stand the weakness. Understand? In other words, they don't. If you come in and you display weakness, you can see the way that they treat women very much relates to this also. They don't value any kind of physical weakness, emotion. It doesn't bring out mercy in them. It brings out cruelty. The strongest way to barter with somebody, and the shuk, is to be tougher than them and sharper than them. If you get into a taxi and you're super friendly, they'll charge you more. And it's very different. Here, you're more likely to get a discount by being really friendly. So that's that value. In other words, there's plenty of Torah values that went someone to this place, someone to that place. There are plenty of things that are missing in Christian culture that are present more in Islam instead. But this is one of the things that we see. They always identify with the underdog. And by the way, that's why everybody was so, all the liberals were so pro the state of Israel in 48. They were the underdog. Now they're not the underdog. Now they're the imperialist conquerors. So now you switch. Now you're the other people, the underdog. It's very straightforward. That's the whole story. I mean, if you really get to the bottom of it, whoever's the underdog, we root for. It could be a mosquito. It could be a cow that's being led to slaughter. Whatever it is, whoever is in the weaker position, that's who we support. So it doesn't come from nowhere, because there is this pasuk. There is this really, really powerful pasuk. In Koheles. Can anybody pronounce that in English? Koheles?
Koheles.
How do you say it in English?
Ecclesiastes.
There you go, Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes. Yeah, that's not that's no simple thing. What has been? That's true. It's now
Greek
English.
Yeah.
No words in English are really English.
Leviticus.
What has been already exists, and what is still to be, has already been. And Elokim, Devakesh, es nirdaf. God always seeks the pursued. Hashem always seeks out the pursued. Doesn't mean hard to understand. Whoever's being chased, nirdaf. If one person's being chased, it says the Medrash Rabba here in Vayikra 27. Elokim Yivakesh as nirdaf. God seeks out, avenges the pursued. Rav Huna taught in the name of Yosef. La'olam. Always, fellow Kemirakesh Nira, always, God will do so. If you find a righteous person running after another righteous person, attacking him, being cruel to him, God will side with the underdog. If a wicked person is being chased by a tzaddik, afilu tzaddik rodef rasha, fellow Kemirakesh Nira. So, if somebody is being chased and attacked and vilified, crucified, right there, going after him, Hashem is on his side. That's what it is. Mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling. It's something really to consider that there's a certain virtue. There's a certain, when somebody's being attacked, part of being Hashem, part of the nature of Hashem, it doesn't stand for that. Always, no matter what. Okay, sometimes it's justified if Hashem says you put this person to death. Right, Hashem says you don't speak to this person, you don't engage with that. That's not what it means. It means unjustly. But it can be the most righteous person in the world. The most righteous person in the world who gets up and says, this man is a wicked man. But it's unjust, it's a mistake. He was fed false information. Hashem is on the second guy's side, not the first guy's side. That's what this Medrash is telling us. That's unbelievable. No matter how righteous, how good you are. There's a very powerful story about Rabbi Aryeh Levin. Rabbi Aryeh Levin was the tzaddik of Yerushalayim. He was Rabbi Eliashiv's father-in-law. His daughter married Eliashiv. He was going to drill the Hadar himself. And the story goes like this. The story came out at his 30th yard site. This fellow, a certain rabbi in Yerushalayim, or in Israel rather, who was very, very interesting. He's apparently in the upper echelons of the education system. A very prominent educator. So he's told a story about how did he get there. He was an orphan, no parents. He was raised in an orphanage in old Jerusalem. And Rabbi Aryeh Levin, who was the rabbi of Yerushalayim, was really in charge of that orphanage. You know, it's a generally visit a few times a year kind of thing. They would ask their big questions. And, okay. So this fellow describes as a boy, he was always hungry. It was a very poor city. There just wasn't really enough food for these kids, and he was always hungry. One day, they served chocolate pudding. And a big bowl of chocolate pudding. This is a really special treat. And the boy got in line and got his bowl and got a bowl of pudding. And then he raced back to his seat, gobbled it up, and got back in line and tried to get a second helping. Welcome. So he tried to get a second helping of this pudding. Well, what happens? When he gets into line, the guy who's serving it makes some sort of snide remark. Yeah, now, I mean, I just want you to understand. I was describing this story once. I once told this story to my daughter, Shifra. She was like 6 or 5, you know. Close to Yael recently, you know. So listen to this. I was telling this story to my daughter, Shifra, so she looks at me. And she says, but why would they not let him have more dessert? You understand? When you grew up in a healthy, normal family, like, why would you not let somebody have more dessert? And where were his parents? Where were they, though? I mean, why weren't they there? It's a very hard story to understand. And this little boy asks for more, and they say, absolutely not. So what does he do? He throws a fit, like children will sometimes do. He took the whole serving bowl of pudding and threw it onto the floor. And he was publicly shamed and spanked. Yeah, he was hit and he was screamed at. And he was told that, like, you have until tomorrow morning we'll know what to do with you because Rabbi Levin is coming. And he'll decide if you should be expelled or not. Thrown out. So Shifra asked him, but then where would he go live? That's a really good question. That's what he was wondering. Where will I live? I don't have parents. I don't have any family. I live in an orphanage. Where are you going to throw me out? So this kid is... The next day, Rabbi Levin comes and sits down with him, and he says, listen. He says, did you do it? Did you spill the bowl of stuff so pussy? So he said, will you do it again? He says, oh, I'm so happy. Then he says, you like pudding, right? So he gets, apparently... So he takes out two, like, little bowls of chocolate pudding, and he sits there with the boy, and they sat together and they ate their pudding together. And then he said, okay, have a good day. Fine. And he left. And he said, it's then that I understood what it means to be a Torah Jew. This little boy, he said, that was when he understood, like, wow, that's a tonic, like, that's it. And he went on to be a big educator. And he devoted his life to building up children and not publicly shaming them. He had a really hard child. Halach ma'anya, when you focus on the bread of affliction that you used to eat or your ancestors used to eat or is in your collective history, the solution has to be how can we make the world a better place? Jews are fantastic at doing that. They're fantastic at doing that. You kick them all out of one country and you kill half of them on the way out and they come to the next one and they try to contribute. And they do. And then they kick them out of that one and they go to the next one. Because that's really the healthiest way. We learned that from Yitzhak Mitzrayim, you know, freedom. It's really tough. Most people don't do well with freedom. Because your whole orientation was to be free. You worked for years, you fought, you marched, you wanted freedom, you wanted equality. Good, now you're free, now what? Oh. And they said, you know, you notice in South Africa, they had tremendous trouble with this. Tremendous trouble. I mean, rightfully so, people fought for equal rights. And once they had it, it's taken a long time. And the effects are still not over. A bunch of people are like, okay, now what are we going to fight for? Now what are we? What do we do? We're free to do what? It's no simple thing. I mean, I don't know that there's a simple solution. So the Torah has a very simple thing. You come out, you start counting things very slowly, right away. You come out, there's a very clear goal. You're trying to head here. You're trying to do this. And that's going to be at the end when we're headed to the land of Israel. Instead, the end of Halach Ma'anya is Lashana Haba. There's somewhere that we're going here. There's some major... So we'll see that in a minute. show you something interesting that just gets explained by this. I had this in my notes. So there is a there's something that Yosef Gigi. It was an important important tzaddik. Wrote a Haggadah 120 years, but big sorry. And Gigi, this is not an Ashkenazi. So he quotes in the Maharil, he quotes from an early source that says the following interesting thing. He says that Mem Tzadi He, if you write out matzah, Mem, Tzadi Dal Yud, Mem Tzadi He, Hey Yud, the gematria is tzedakah. Gematria is tzedakah. So he says it's very, very important to be charitable on and around Pesach. It's very, very important. It's a big part of the mitzvah. So now we understand why a little bit, and why it's hinted to in the word matzah, of all words. Why of all words matzah? Instead, it could be hinted to in the word Pesach. No. Because matzah is the signal that we used to eat this bread of affliction. Halach ma'anya. We really had it hard. The symbol of how hard we had it is that we are devoted to making the world a place where nobody else has to deal with that ever again. Where we give charity, where we're kind to others. This is a tremendously different approach than most people will ever have. And that's how we started the Seder. Okay, a word about the bread, about lach ma'anya, which means the Gemara says lechem oni. The Torah calls matzah lechem oni, which means poor bread, simple bread. So the Gemara says really, really it hints to something else, and that's lechem, bread, she'onim alav, that we respond over it. We speak up over this bread, dvarim harbe, many things. We have a lot to say about this bread. So the Seder is done over matzah, and matzah is almost like bread of talking. It's bread that you talk about a lot. That's what it means. That's halach ma'anya. That's what we mean. This is the bread that we talk about. You know, the only thing we eat before the Haggadah, what do we eat? What do you eat? Kaddish, or what's karpas? What's karpas?
Vegetable?
It is some vegetable. It's got to be a vegetable. It should be green. It should be right. A potato with celery, parsley, right? I prefer anything but parsley. Right, you dip in the salt water, that's significant. Salt is a mineral. Karpas is a vegetable. There's a Gemara that says, Am Ha'aretz. A person who doesn't live a life of Torah. An Am Ha'aretz, the Rambam says, is a person whose life is about supporting the land. After all, the land has to exist. So he's kind of like a cog in a wheel, but he's not particularly significant. It's a person who lives with no mission, with no spiritual purpose. That's an Am Ha'aretz. There's still a purpose Hashem's using. He needs to keep the world going. And how many people it goes into one piece of bread that you had? I mean, how many people were involved in getting it onto the truck and off the truck and watering the field and delivering the... I mean, unbelievable. So, you need Am Ha'aretz. In any event, an Am Ha'aretz, says the Gemara, Asur Lechol Basar. He is prohibited from eating meat. What right do you have to go eat meat? Who do you think you are? We're all a bunch of animals. It's cannibalism. And the truth is, that's true. The only reason you'd be able to eat meat is the following basic approach. And you could talk about it as elevating holy sparks. And here's what it means. It means the following. If you could really ask a cow, would you rather be part... Okay, the cow doesn't have a conscious mind, right? But if you could ask the soul, if you could ask the cow, would you rather be part of spiritual meaning? Would you rather be part of the energy used for that fireman to bust into that house and save three children from the burning flames? Or would you rather wander around here another few months and then die? By the way, we'll kill you painlessly. Would you rather be part, if you ask normal human beings that, would you rather die to save 1,000 innocent children, or would you rather go on living? What are you going to live for anyway? I mean, most people would give their lives for the things they believe in. And then you see it all over the world. They're going to war and they're giving their lives. People and animals and everything in the world is created with the entire purpose of serving Hashem, being a big part of the universe and the big picture, and they're very, very happy to do so. Now, practically, I don't know what you're going to ask the cow, but would you rather, if you were a cow, be eaten by something? Imagine now you're going to be eaten in a hot dog eating contest. I was put in this world with a special cow life force, and now someone's going to shovel me in. No blessing, no anything. Awful. Can you imagine what's going on? The Hasidim Shasharim talk about it as if there are holy sparks that need to go up to Shemayim in every bit of food, and there are neshamas almost. Maybe other human beings are reincarnated into that cow, perhaps. But the idea is there's so much spiritual potential in it, and they're waiting for you to make a blessing. They're waiting for you to make something out of this animal. Everything in the world wants to be elevated. And instead, you're going to shovel it in, you're not going to make a blessing, you're not going to say, well, that's a tragedy. Okay, so an Amma Arif doesn't get to eat me. What right do you have to eat me? There's a special emphasis eating meat on Shabbos and Yom Tov. After all, if you were a cow, would you rather be eaten during the week? At a business lunch? Or at a Shabbos meal? Where they're singing songs, right? I mean, and at a Shabbos meal where the people are cruel to each other and they kick each other under the table when they make bad jokes and they don't sing any songs or talk about Torah, or one where they talk about Torah and they're friendly and they have guests. You understand? You know, it's a very, very straightforward line of reasoning that you could explain to a three-year-old. What right do you have to eat meat if you're just a pig? But if you're a human being, certainly. Until we speak, we use our power of speech, which is such a uniquely human thing, to talk about ideas and spirituality, which is not a gun. It says the Ostrovs are gone. Right? The mayor, Yechiel Halevi of Ostrovs, and he says that we can only eat vegetables. The first thing we do at the Seder is we identify, listen, we have no right to eat meat. Mineral and vegetable is for us, because we're just animals. So we take salt water, and we take a vegetable, and we eat that. Now, if we do Haggadah, if we say Dvarim Harve, many beautiful words, and we talk about Hashem, and we appreciate where we're coming from, and we have a goal in life, and we know that one day we're going to achieve the total redemption, and we're so confident about this, that's saying Hallel, because we feel like we just came out of Egypt, and we know that's going to happen to us in our lifetime. A person who lives a life like that, sit down and eat some meat, Korban Pesach, you make a bracha on it, fantastic, eat some meat. But until that point, you don't get to heaven. So, that's already a big deal. It's a very beautiful idea. That we want to recognize and emphasize at our Seder that what gives us the right to call ourselves something, a chosen people, a special people, a relationship with Hashem, is because of the things we're going to talk about in a moment, the things that we're going to think about, the way that we engage in the world as a human. It's not worth very much otherwise. We would only be able to eat vegetables. And he said, that's where we start the Seder off with a vegetable. Because at the beginning of the Seder, indeed, that's all we really have the right to eat. Now, Kol ha'osek b'torah l'shma, it says in Pirkei Avos, anybody who studies Torah sincerely, zocheh l'dvarim harbe, he merits many things. Some of the commentators say Dvarim Harbe means many words. Just like he said, Onim Alav, they respond over the matzah, Dvarim Harbe, many words, a lot of talking, so that a person who studies Torah gets lots of talking. So what does that mean? Now, generally, and this is a general principle, some of the Swami already say this about the Seder, they say about Ayel Meshulash and others, there's a general principle in your own life. And that is that the more that you talk about something, the less of an impact it has on you. So let's say a person's a therapist. And they have someone who comes in who went through tremendous trouble. So the goal is to get them to speak about it clearly. Because once they've spoken about it, it's like, okay, now I can take that thing and write it in this file, and now it's here. A person goes through the Holocaust and feels like I went through too much, they'll never speak about it. Somebody said, we all know people like that. Why would they never speak about it? Because that would cheapen it. And in many ways, they're right. Sometimes the most powerful thing is not a word, but like the Sfarim talk about this when they talk about the shofar blast. It's like a primal call. It's not something that you can really put words to. It's just a cry. And that's above words. The Hasidish Rebbes talk about it, about nigunim, the ability to sing without words, just to kind of sing. Without attaching any specific pasuk or words or thought to this. Because it can be larger than any specific thought process. And so too, if you're inspired by something, if there's something that really inspires you, the more that you talk about it, the more it wears off. And the less you, and that's not easy. Because we're bursting, we want to say everything. But sometimes you got to keep things in. There are great, I think the Alter of Kelm writes that there were things that he held on to for many years. And only when he found that they weren't so inspirational for him anymore did he start to inspire others by teaching those same ideas. But that sometimes you got to hold on to something. There's an internal space. One thing that I would highly, highly, highly recommend that people do occasionally, once in a while, you could do it a few times a year, but it's to learn something, study something, some idea, something that you're not going to tell anybody about. It's not some highly secret thing. You're going to learn something you're not going to teach anyone, and you're not going to tell anyone, and you're just going to learn it, and you're going to hold on to it for a few months before you ever quote it. Oh, I saw this really interesting thing from Rabbi Krump. No. Just hang on to it, and remember, you're learning for yourself. You're learning to be a better person, not just learning to be able to have something to show off, or to quote, or to give shurim a bag. You know, it's also important to teach. It's also important to share. It's also important to inspire people. But there's got to be that internal world of inspiration. Okay, so now that we know that talking a lot can often interfere with our ability to stay inspired. The Seder is something different to the Chasam something. I'm sorry. They say that the Chasam, you know, that the Seder is a time when we're supposed to talk a ton. But there's a special power of inspiration. And Hashem promises that on this one night, you will not lose out too much. If you talk a lot here, you will retain the inspiration. Call Hamar Bel Sakra. The more that a person speaks, it's very special. So even though normally, you know, Shiag L'Chach Mashtika, to really keep your wisdom in, requires a little bit of silence. To be able to know when to hold your tongue, at the Seder night, it's a little bit different. We're looking to express, we're looking to bring out. So that segues us into the third, you know, connecting, you know, two and three. Because it goes like this. We already said that it started in the beginning of Halachma Anya. We said this is the bread of affliction. If you're hungry, come and eat. Means our response to suffering and challenge is to look outward and try to impact others and make the world a better place. So we're holding it at tzedakah. It's called Dichon Yisrael. That's tzedakah. That's anybody who's hungry, come and eat. The Beis HaLevi says in the Zakara, first drop of Christmas, Yosha Ber Salvation. So he says, there's a medrash. In the merit of charity, we are redeemed. Mashiach comes in the merit of tzedakah. There's such a medrash, such a chazal. So therefore, the moment that we've opened our home to other people, we can say, Hashem, this year we're here, but next year we're confident that we're a little closer to Yerushalayim. Next year we can be in Yerushalayim. It's more reasonable than it was a second ago because we've been kind. We've done tzedakah. B'shaveha b'tzedakah, the pasuk even says, as a pasuk, b'shaveha b'tzedakah, that they'll come back to Yerushalayim for charity. So what's the idea behind that? Why should it be? Why would it be that one mitzvah? There's lots of mitzvahs. There's lots of mitzvahs. Why would that be the thing that redeems us? So here's a little bit of insight. Here's a little bit of a possibility. Like, what is, I mean, if a person had to define what it means that Mashiach is going to come, and the world's going to be a perfect place. So the Navi says that the lion, the gar ze'ev in keves, the wolf will live together with the sheep, the lion will lay down with the lamb. What's that all about? What's that all about? It means that everybody will find their place. You don't need it to get wealthy at someone else's expense. Nobody has anything that's yours. You found your place and your contribution and your spot in the world. It's what everybody's looking for. It's the hardest possible thing. We're so jealous of other people, but why don't I look like that one? Why don't I feel like that one? Why aren't I talented like him? And why do they have so much money? It's very hard. So just kind of look at ourselves and be comfortable exactly who we are. It's one of the hardest challenges, and that's because Mashiach is everybody getting who they are. It describes all the tzaddikim standing around Hashem in a circle. God's going to make a big circle of dancing for the tzaddikim. He'll sit in between them, and everyone will point with their finger and say, Zeh Hashem kivinu lo. But Amar b'yamahu, hine elokeinu zeh. He'll say on that day, this is our God, Zeh Hashem. They'll all point, all in a circle. So that's an interesting thing. That's Mashiach. That's where everybody's going to be. But we spoke about it when we were talking about tefillin a little bit. We spoke about that Gemara. And we explained that the Omar by Yomahu, he will say on that day, Hine Elokeinu Zeh, this is our God. Mashiach time is when everybody can recognize this is our God. That's how you can see that there will be a circle. Because a circle is equidistant. So even though I'm on this side and you're all the way on that side, I can recognize we're both pointing at the same God. So we have a different approach, we have a different route. Until Mashiach time, it won't be like that. The Gemara says, Tia emes ne'ederes. The Torah will be Adarim Adarim. There will be different groups of people trying to keep the Torah. Everybody's saying that the other one is a bunch of pigs. Disgusting people, they don't do it just right, they're not doing it wrong. I can't believe how they behave. That's what's going to be before Mashiach comes. So at least that part we can see is very, very clear. And Be'ez Hashem, we'll get to the point where everyone can sort of stand and join hands and realize we're all pointing at the same Hashem. No, but the Rebbe said you must face east. Yeah, but that's because you guys are on that side. I have to face west, and I face east, I'm facing away. Don't you understand? And we'll understand it. Bringing out the best in ourselves to know who we really are is done through tzedakah. It's not done through taking, it's done through giving. Let me sort of explain that. There's a few ways to understand this. There's one Gemara that says, it's Gemara at the end of Ksuvos. And it says in the brachas of Yaakov to his children, so he says that Yehuda Mavein Shinayim Mechalov. You will have white teeth because of milk. You'll have red eyes because of all the wine, and white teeth because of all the milk. You'll be doing fine. White teeth. Lavein shinayim. So Gemara says, whitening your teeth at somebody, smiling at somebody, is better than giving them a drink of milk. Better than giving somebody physical needs is giving them their emotional needs. So you all know that friend who was so jealous of them. They were a kid. They were so wealthy. They had everything they wanted. They never said no. They wanted the fanciest vacations. And they would have given it all up if they could have had a father and a mother who would have given them a little bit of attention. And just given them some emotion. We all understand that principle. That the emotional needs are far more important. The difference even between physical suffering and emotional abuse. A person who has a childhood where they had terrible physical agony. They hurt themselves. They were in a terrible accident. They were suffering. And a person who is emotionally abused is so much worse. A person can be physically suffering and emotionally strong. So much better than being physically strong and emotionally destroyed. So the Gemara says that when a person, an ani, comes to your door, when a poor man comes to your door and knocks and says, can I have some food? And you give him food, you've done a mitzvah. But you've done a much greater mitzvah when you cheer him up. Of course, the best thing to do is do both. You know, instead of give him a couple dollars and cheer him up. But if you didn't have anything, and you turn to the guy and said, sorry, I don't have anything for you. Or, how about this? The guy knocks on your door, and you don't have time for him. You're on the phone. So you tell him, it's after 9 o'clock. What kind of an outrage did you knock on the door? Give him $100 and slam the door in his face. Comes to the next door neighbor. The guy says, you know, my cupboards are empty. I don't have anything. I'm really sorry. But you're always welcome to come back. Maybe next time you come, I'll have a bowl of soup for you. But I'm so happy you came. I know you'll get back on your feet. Yeah. These things are a cycle. Soon you'll be helping out other people. I have nothing for you, but you're my friend. That's a much bigger mitzvah than the person who gave the $100. Now the best thing would be if we can do both. Be'ez Hashem, we'll have plenty of money, we'll be able to help everybody, and we'll be able to cheer them up. Okay, that's the teaching. So, but there's another layer to this. Besides the emotional, physical dichotomy, there's another layer to this. And it goes like this. Every person's uniquely placed in the world to do things that no one else could do. So it means if you're sitting on the bus next to somebody, nobody else is sitting next to that person today. There's only one person sitting next to that person on the bus. So when you smile at the person, you say, good morning, you were the only person in the whole world who could have done that thing, right? And we're all, and in a larger scale, okay, the person on the bus is probably less important to you than the person who's going to be your nephew or your niece. But there's really only one or two people who are going to be able to be their uncle or aunt in the whole world, or five or six or ten. And of those people, who's going to really get positive influence and build them up, and they'll always know, loves me unconditionally, no matter. So to handle that well, and to not go months and months without speaking to those nieces and nephews, or this is a tremendous responsibility, and it's something we can contribute a great deal. When you smile at somebody, what you do is you give something that nobody else in the whole world can give. If all of us got together and each gave $5, and then we handed over that big pool of money to the poor man on Purim, hey, here's all the matanos levyonim that we got. Everybody gave $5. It makes no difference to him or to the world. Certainly in your neshama, if it was your last $5, it's a different level of giving than for the multimillionaire who notices it less than you notice a penny. But in the world of the person receiving it, there's no difference. But when you smile and offer a relationship with you, you're offering something nobody else could ever offer this world, before or after. So giving of yourself, the highest level of charity is going to be when you find out who you are and you can give that. So alt tzedaka, you'll find that very often one person is involved in kiruv, and they're doing outreach weekends, and another person is working with Tomchei Shabbos, and the third person, and every single person. And I was thinking about this a lot recently, how like every single person has things that completely speak to them and reach them, and other things that don't. And it's not that they don't respect it. Wow, that's wonderful. But like Israel Bonds is not their thing. It's just not their thing. It doesn't speak to them. And another person, they're raising enormous amounts of money. We've got to support this Jewish land packed with Jews. And like there's no clear right answer in the laws of tzedakah. It's incredibly subjective. Rabbi Yitzchak Berkowitz, the big rabbi of Yerushalayim, who I was privileged to study with a little bit under, rather, study under, I mean, it wasn't my conversion. But Rabbi Berkowitz used to say, and he has on his tapes on tzedakah, where he says that one of the most beautiful things about tzedakah is it's each person's own opportunity to really find what things really do speak to me and what really needs me. And there's no way that you can tell a person, no, but everybody must go in this direction or that direction. Mashiach comes. The world is perfected. We bring the world a lot closer to a world where everyone has found their place and their own self when we get to that. When we engage in a worldview that looks outward, it doesn't look at what do we need. And so, that's how we will conclude our Halach Ma'anyan approach. This is the bread of affliction. It really was tough for us. If you're hungry, come and eat, because we had it hard. So if anybody else in the world, if you have something inside of yourself that still causes you pain, if there's something that you had when you were a child, if there's some way that you were treated that you don't like it, people are not helping me in A, B, and C. I need more. So then figure out a way to make the difference. Figure out a way that maybe it's not going to be today. But realistically, commit to yourself that when I get over this drug addiction, when I get the right shit, I'm going to make sure that the people that are behind me in line have an easier time with this. Because that's what we do. We don't just say, oh, thank God I'm over that. Now, you're all on your own. And by the way, you're never, ever, ever going to find somebody else who will understand it as well as you. You tell me, you know how hard it is for me, I'll try to empathize. But I had a different thing. Instead. And that kid who was treated terribly in the orphanage, so he had a different thing, and he's not going to solve the shit of crisis, but he may help a lot of orphans. And so we conclude then, we say, listen, now that we've understood that the orientation is charity, you got to know that that is our methodology, that's our plan. You know how we're going to get Mashiach here? You know how we're going to empty out the children's hospitals and throw away the IV poles and watch the hair grow back? Instead, how are you going to cure every ailment in the world? Stop every war, it's going to be through tzedakah. It's going to be through allowing people to find each of their own places. And then we can look forward to the day, the Daven Beder and Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, that Ve'yasu Kulam Atuda Achas, that the whole world will get together in one giant unit to do Hashem's will. Instead, everybody's orientation will be, how can I contribute more? How can I make more of a difference? That's what we're hoping for. And that's what we start this year, Pesach, you know, we'll get started on the process. Okay, thanks everyone for joining us. This was really nice. Thank you.